Two peoples, two branches split from the same tree. "Let us out!" they shouted, until their voices grew hoarse from the words. Nothing but silence greeted them. "Chief Abeeku," another said, "we should not be doing this. Our Ashanti allies will be furious if they know we have worked with their enemies." The one called chief threw up his hands. "Today the enemies pay more, Fifi," he said. "Tomorrow, if they pay more, we will work with them too. This is how you build a village, do you understand?" Essie watched the one called Fifi. He was young for a warrior, but already she could tell that one day he would be a big man too. He shook his head, but didn't speak again. He went out of the cellar and brought back more men. They were white men, the first Essie had ever seen. She could not match their skin to any tree or nut or mud or clay that she had ever encountered. "These people do not come from nature," she said. "I told you, they have come to eat us," Tansy replied. The white men approached them. "Stand up," the chief shouted, and they all stood. The chief turned to one of the white men. "See, Governor James," he said in fast Fonti, so fast Essie hardly understood him and wondered how this white man could. "The Ashanti are very strong. You may check them for yourselves." The men started to undress the ones who still had clothes on, checking them. For what? Essie didn't know. She remembered the stone tucked in a cloth wrapper, and when the one called Fifi reached her to undo the knot she had tied at the top of it, she launched a long, full stream of spit into his face. He did not cry like the boy captive she had spit on in her own village square. He did not whimper, or cower, or seek comfort. He simply wiped his face, never taking his eyes off her. The chief came to stand next to him. "What will you do about this, Fifi? Will you let this go unpunished?" the chief asked. He spoke low, so that only Essie and Fifi could hear. Then, the sound of the smack. It was so loud, it took a moment for Essie to determine whether the pain she felt was on her ear or inside it. She cowered and sank to the ground, covering her face and crying. The smack had popped the stone from her wrapper, and she found it there on the ground. She cried even harder, trying to distract them now. Then she laid her head against the smooth black stone. The coolness of it soothed her face, and when the men had finally turned their backs and left her there, forgetting for a moment to take off her wrapper, Essie took the stone from against her cheek and swallowed it. Now the waste on the dungeon floor was up to Essie's ankles. There had never been so many women in the dungeon before. Essie could hardly breathe, but she moved her shoulders this way and that until she had created some space. The woman beside her had not stopped leaking waste since the last time the soldiers fed them. Essie remembered her first day in the dungeon, when the same thing had been true of her. That day, she had found her mother's stone in the river of shit. She had buried it, marking the spot on the wall so that she would remember when the time came. "Shh, shh, shh," Essie cooed to the woman. "Shh, shh, shh." She had learned to stop saying that everything would be all right. Before long, the door of the dungeon opened and a sliver of light peeked through. A couple of soldiers walked in. Something was wrong with these soldiers. There was less order to their movements, less structure. She had seen men drunk from palm wine before, the way their faces flushed and their gestures grew wilder, the way their hands moved as though ready to collect even the very air around them. The soldiers looked around, and the women in the dungeon began to murmur. One of them grabbed a woman on the far end and pushed her against the wall. His hands found her breasts, and then began to move down the length of her body, lower and lower still, until the sound that escaped her lips was a scream. The women in the stack started to hiss then. The hiss said, "Quiet, stupid girl, or they will beat us all." The hiss was high and sharp, the collective cry of 150 women filled with anger and fear. The soldier, who had his hands on the woman, began to sweat. He shouted back at them all. Their voices hushed to a hum, but did not stop. The murmur vibrated so low, Essie felt as though it were coming from her own stomach. "What are they doing?" they hissed. "What are they doing?" The hissing grew louder, and soon the men were shouting something back at them. The other soldier was still walking around, looking at each woman carefully. When he came upon Essie, he smiled, and for one quick second, she confused that act as one of kindness, for it had been so long since she'd seen someone smile. He said something, and then his hands were on her arm. She tried to fight him, but the lack of food and the wounds from the beatings had left her too weak to even collect her saliva and spit at him. He laughed at her attempt and dragged her by the elbow out of the room. As they walked into the light, Essie looked at the scene behind her, all those women hissing and crying. He took her to his quarters above the place where she and the rest of the slaves had been kept. Essie was so unused to light that now it blinded her. She couldn't see where she was being taken. When they got to his quarters, he gestured toward a glass of water. But Essie stood still. He gestured to the whip that sat on his desk. She nodded, took one sip of the water, and watched it slip out of her numb lips. He put her on a folded top, spread her legs, and entered her. She screamed, but he placed his hand over her lips, then put his fingers in her mouth. Biting them only seemed to please him, and so she stopped. She closed her eyes, forcing herself to listen instead of see, pretending that she was still the little girl in her mother's hut on a night that her father had come in, that she was still looking at the mud walls, wanting to give them privacy, to separate herself, wanting to understand what kept pleasure from turning into pain. When he had finished, he looked horrified, disgusted with her, as though he were the one who had had something taken from him. As though he were the one who had been violated. Suddenly, Essie knew that the soldier had done something that even the other soldiers would find fault with. He looked at her like her body was his shame. Once night fell, and the light receded, leaving only the darkness that Essie had come to know so well, the soldier snuck her out of his quarters. She had finished her crying, but still he shushed her. He wouldn't look at her, only forced her along, down, down, back to the dungeons. When she got there, the murmur had subsided. The women were no longer crying or hissing. There was only silence as the soldier returned her to her spot. Days went on, the cycle repeated. Food, then no food. Essie could do nothing but replay her time in the light. She had not stopped bleeding since that night. A thin trickle of red traveled down her leg, and Essie just watched it. She no longer wanted to talk to Tonsi. She no longer wanted to listen to stories. She had been wrong when she'd watched her parents that night as they worked together in her mother's hut. There was no pleasure. The dungeon door opened. A couple of soldiers walked in, and Essie recognized one of them from the cellar in Fantyland. He was tall, and his hair was the color of tree bark after rain. But the color was starting to turn gray. There were many golden buttons along his coat and on the flaps above the shoulders. She thought and thought, trying to push out the cobwebs that had formed in her brain and remember what the chief had called the man. Governor James. He walked through the room, his boots pressing against hands, thighs, hair, his fingers pinching his nose. Following behind him was a younger soldier. The big white man pointed to 20 women, then to Essie. The soldier shouted something, but they didn't understand. He grabbed them by their wrists, dragged them from atop or underneath the bodies of other women so that they were standing upright. He stood them next to each other in a row, and the governor checked them. He ran his hands over their breasts and between their thighs. The first girl he checked began to cry, and he slapped her swiftly, knocking her body back to the ground. Finally, Governor James came to Essie. He looked at her carefully, then blinked his eyes and shook his head. He looked at her again, and then began checking her body as he had the others. When he ran his hands between her legs, his fingers came back red. He gave her a pitying look, as though he understood. But Essie wondered if he could. He motioned, and before she could think, the other soldier was herding them out of the dungeon. "No! My stone!" Essie shouted, remembering the golden black stone her mother had given her. She flung herself to the ground and started to dig, and dig, and dig. But then the soldier was lifting her body, and soon all that she could feel instead of dirt in her steadily moving hands was air, and more air. They took them out into the light. The scent of ocean water hit her nose. The taste of salt clung to her throat. The soldiers marched them down to an open door that led to sand and water, and they all began to walk out onto it. Before Essie left, the one called Governor looked at her and smiled. It was a kind smile, pitying, yet true. But for the rest of her life, Essie would see a smile on a white face and remember the one the soldier gave her before taking her to his quarters. How white men smiling just meant more evil was coming with the next wave. Quay had received a message from his old friend Kudrow and didn't know how he would answer it. That night, he pretended the heat was keeping him awake. An easy lie, for he was drenched in sweat. But then, when wasn't he sweating? It was so hot and humid in the bush that he felt like he was being slowly roasted for supper. He missed the castle, the breeze from the beach. Here, in the village of his mother, Ephia, sweat pooled in his ears, in his belly button. His skin itched, and he imagined mosquitoes crawling up his feet to his legs to his stomach, to rest at the watering hole of his navel. Did mosquitoes drink sweat, or was it only blood? Blood. He pictured the prisoners being brought into the cellars by the tens and twenties, their hands and feet bound and bleeding. He wasn't made for this. He was supposed to have an easier life, away from the workings of slavery. He was raised among the whites in Cape Coast, educated in England. He should still be in his office in the castle, working as a writer. The junior officer rank that his father, James Collins, had secured for him before his death. Logging numbers that he could pretend didn't represent people bought and sold. Instead, the castle's new governor had summoned him, sent him here, to the bush. "As you know by now, Quay, We've had a long-standing working relationship with Abbe Kubadu and the other Negroes of his village. But of late, we've heard that they have begun trading with a few private companies. We would like to set up an outpost in the village that would act as a residence for a few of our employees, as a way of, say, gently reminding our friends there that they have certain trade obligations to our company. You've been specially requested for the position, and given your parents' history with the village, and given your comfort and familiarity with the language and local customs, we thought that you might be a particular asset to our company while there. Kwe had nodded and accepted the position, because what else could he do? But inside, he resisted. His comfort and familiarity with the local customs, his parents' history with the village. Kwe was still in Efia's womb the last time he or his mother had been there, so scared was she of Baba. That was in 1779, nearly 20 years ago. Baba had died in those years, and yet still, they had stayed away. Kwe felt his new job was a kind of punishment, and hadn't he been punished enough? The sun finally came up, and Kwe went to see his uncle Fifi. When they'd met for the first time, only a month before, Kwe could hardly believe that a man like Fifi was related to him. It wasn't that he was handsome. Efia had been called the beauty her whole life, and so Kwe was accustomed to beauty. It was that Fifi looked powerful, his body a graceful alliance of muscles. Kwe had taken after his father, skinny and tall, but not particularly strong. James was powerful, but his power had come from his pedigree, the Collinses of Liverpool, who'd gained their wealth building slave ships. His mother's power came from her beauty, but Fifi's power came from his body, from the fact that he looked like he could take anything he wanted. Kwe had known only one other person like that. "Ah, my son, you are welcome here," Fifi said when he saw Kwe approaching. "Sit, eat." Summoned, the housegirl came out with two bowls. She started to set one bowl in front of Fifi, but he stopped her with only a glance. "You must serve my son first." "Sorry," she mumbled, setting the bowl in front of Kwe instead. Kwe thanked her and looked down at the porridge. "Uncle, we've been here a month already, and yet, still, you haven't discussed our trade agreements. The company has the money to buy more, much more, but you have to let us. You have to stop trading with any other company." Kwe had given this very speech or one like it many times before, but his uncle Fifi always ignored him. The first night they were there, Kwe had wanted to talk to Badu about the trade agreements straight away. He thought the sooner he could get the chief to agree, the sooner he could leave. That night, Badu had invited all the men to drink at his compound. He brought them enough wine and aputeshi to drown in. Timothy Hightower, an officer eager to impress the chief, drank half a caskful of the home brew before he passed out underneath a palm tree, shaking and vomiting and claiming to see spirits. Soon the rest of the men also littered the forest of Badu's front yard, vomiting, or sleeping, or searching for a local woman to sleep with. Kwe waited for his chance to speak to Badu, sipping his drink all the while. He had had only two cups of wine before Fifi approached him. "Careful, Kwe," Fifi said, pointing at the scene of men before them. "Stronger men than these have been brought down by too much drink." Kwe looked at the cup in Fifi's hand, his eyebrow raised. "Water," Fifi said. "One of us must be ready for anything." He motioned to Badu, who had fallen asleep in his gold throne, his chin nestled down into the round flesh of his belly. Quay laughed, and Fifi cracked a smile, the first that Quay had seen since meeting him. Quay never talked to Badu that night, but as the weeks went on, he learned that it was not Badu he needed to please. While Abeku Badu was the figurehead, the Omanhin who received gifts from the political leaders of London and Holland alike for his role in their trade, Fifi was the authority. When he shook his head, the whole village stopped. Now Fifi was as silent as he was every other time Quay had brought up trade with the British. He looked out into the forest in front of them, and Quay followed his gaze. In the trees, two vibrant birds sang loudly, a discordant song. "Uncle, the agreement Badu made with my father. Do you hear that?" Fifi asked, pointing to the birds. Frustrated, Quay nodded. "When one bird stops, the other one starts. Each time their song gets louder, shriller. Why do you think that is?" "Uncle, trade is the only reason we're here. If you want the British out of your village, you have to—" "What you cannot hear, Quay, is the third bird. She's quiet. Quiet. Listening to the male birds get louder and louder and louder still. And when they have sung their voices out, then, and only then, will she speak up. Then and only then will she choose the man whose song she liked better. For now she sits and lets them argue. Who will be the better partner? Who will give her better seed? Who will fight for her when times are difficult? Quay, this village must conduct its business like that female bird. You want to pay more for slaves, pay more. But know that the Dutch will also pay more, and the Portuguese, and even the pirates will pay more too. And while you are all shouting about how much better you are than the others, I will be sitting quietly in my compound, eating my fufu, and waiting for the price I think is right. Now, let us not speak of business any more." Quay sighed. So he would be here forever. The birds had stopped singing. Perhaps they sensed his exasperation. He looked at them, their blue, yellow, orange wings, their hooked beaks. "There were no birds like this in London," Quay said softly. "There was no color. Everything was gray. The sky, the buildings, even the people looked gray." Fifi shook his head. "I don't know why Ephia let James send you to that nonsense country." Quay nodded absently and returned to the porridge in his bowl. Quay had been a lonely child. When he was born, his father built a hut close to the castle so that he, Ephia, and Quay could live more comfortably. In those days, trade had been prosperous. Quay never saw the dungeons, and he had only the faintest idea of what went on in the lower levels of the castle. But he knew that business was good because he rarely saw his father. Every day was for him and Ephia. She was the most patient mother in all of Cape Coast, in all of the Gold Coast. She spoke softly, yet assuredly. She never hit him. Even when the other mothers taunted her, telling her that she would spoil him and that he would never learn. "Learn what?" Ephia would answer. "What did I ever learn from Baba?" And yet Quay did learn. He sat in Ephia's lap as she taught him to speak, repeating a word in both Fanti and English, until Quay could hear in one language an answer in the other. She had only learned how to read and write herself in the first year of Quay's life, and yet she taught him with vigor, holding his small, fat fist in hers as they traced lines and lines and lines together. "How smart you are," she exclaimed when Kuei learned to spell his name without her help. In 1784, on Kuei's fifth birthday, Efia first told him about her own childhood in Badu's village. He learned all the names, Kubi, Baba, Fifi. He learned there was another mother whose name they would never know, that the shimmering black stone Efia always wore about her neck had belonged to this woman, his true grandmother. Telling this story, Efia's face darkened. But the storm passed when Kuei reached up and touched her cheek. "You are my own child," she said. "Mine." And she was his. When he was young, that had been enough. But as he grew older, he began to lament the fact that his family was so small, unlike all of the other families in the Gold Coast, where siblings piled on top of siblings in the steady stream of marriages each powerful man consummated. He wished that he could meet his father's other children, those white Collinses who lived across the Atlantic. But he knew that it would never be. Kuei had only himself, his books, the beach, the castle, his mother. "I'm worried because he has no friends," Efia said to James one day. "He doesn't play with the other castle children." Kuei had almost stepped in the door after a day of building sandcastle replicas of the Cape Coast castle when he heard Efia mention his name, and so he remained outside to listen. "What are we supposed to do about that? You've coddled him, Efia. He's got to learn to do some things on his own." "He should be playing with other Fanti children, village children, so that he can get away from here from time to time. Don't you know anyone?" "I'm home," Kuei announced, perhaps a bit too noisily, not wanting to hear what his father would say next. By the end of the day, he'd forgotten all about it. But weeks later, when Kujo Saki came with his father to visit the castle, Kuei remembered his parents' conversation. Kujo's father was the chief of a prominent Fanti village. He was Abeku Badu's biggest competitor, and he had begun meeting with James Collins to discuss increasing trade when the governor asked him if he might bring his eldest son to one of their meetings. "Kuei, this is Kujo," James said, giving Kuei a small push toward the boy. "You two play while we talk." Kuei and Kujo watched their fathers walk off to a different side of the castle. Once they could hardly make them out anymore, Kujo turned his attention to Kuei. "Are you white?" Kujo had asked him, touching his hair. Kuei recoiled at Kujo's touch, though many others had done the same thing, asked him the same question. "I'm not white," he said softly. "What? Speak up," Kujo said, and so Kuei had repeated himself, nearly shouting. From the distance, the boy's fathers turned to observe the commotion. "Not so loud, Kuei," James said. Kuei could feel color flood into his cheeks, but Kujo had just looked on, clearly amused. "So, you're not white. What are you?" "I'm like you," Kuei said. Kujo held his hand out and demanded that Kuei do the same until they were standing arm to arm, skin touching skin. "Not like me," Kujo said. Kuei had wanted to cry, but that desire embarrassed him. He knew that he was one of the half-caste children of the castle, and, like the other half-caste children, he could not fully claim either half of himself, neither his father's whiteness nor his mother's blackness, neither England nor the Gold Coast. Kujo must have seen the tears fighting to escape Kuei's eyes. "Come now," he said, grabbing Kuei's hand. "My father says they keep big guns here. Show me where." Though he'd asked Kuei to show him, Kujo was the one who began to lead the way, running until the two boys had zipped past their fathers toward the cannons. It was in this way that Kwe and Cujo became friends. 2 weeks after the day they first met, Kwe had received a message from Cujo asking if he would like to visit his village. "Can I go?" Kwe asked his mother. But Ifea was already pushing him out the door, overjoyed at the prospect of a friend. Cujo's was the first village that Kwe had ever spent a lot of time in, and he was amazed at how different it was from the castle and from Cape Coast. There was not even one white person there. No soldiers to say what one could or could not do. Though the children were no strangers to beatings, they were still rowdy, loud, and free. Cujo, who was 11 like Kwe, was already the oldest of 10 children, and he ordered his siblings about as though they were his tiny army. "Go and fetch my friend something to eat," he shouted at his youngest sister when he saw Kwe approaching. The girl was but a toddler, thumb still inseparable from mouth, but she always did as Cujo said as soon as he said it. "Hey, Kwe, look what I found," Cujo said, hardly waiting for Kwe to reach him before opening his palm. 2 small snails were in his hands, their tiny, slimy bodies wriggling between Cujo's fingers. "This one is yours, and this one is mine," Cujo said, pointing them out. "Let's race them." Cujo closed his palm again and started to run. He was faster, and Kwe had a hard time keeping up. When they got to a clearing in the forest, Cujo got down on his stomach and motioned for Kwe to do the same. He gave Kwe his snail, then marked a line in the dirt as the starting point. The two boys put their snails behind the line, then released them. At first, neither snail moved. "Are they stupid?" Cujo asked, prodding his snail with his index finger. "You're free, stupid snails. Go! Go!" "Maybe they're just shocked," Kwe said. And Cujo looked at him like he was the one who was stupid. But then Kwe's snail started to move past the line, followed, seconds later, by Cujo's snail. Kwe's snail didn't move like a snail usually did, slowly and deliberately. It was as though he knew he was racing, as though he knew he was free. It didn't take long for the boys to lose sight of him, while Cujo's snail ambled along, even turning in a circle several times. Suddenly, Kwe was nervous. Maybe Cujo would be angry at his loss and tell him to leave the village and never come back. Kwe had only just met Cujo, but already he knew that he didn't want to lose him. He did the only thing he could think to do. He stuck out his hand as he'd often seen his father do after business deals, and to his surprise, Cujo took it. The boys shook. "My snail was very stupid, but yours did well," Cujo said. "Yes, mine did very well," Kwe agreed, relieved. "We should name them. We'll call mine Richard because it's a British name, and he was bad like the British are bad. Yours can be named Kwame." Kwe laughed. "Yes, Richard is bad like the British," he said. He forgot in that second that his own father was British, and when he remembered later, he realized that he didn't care. He felt only that he belonged, fully and completely. The boys grew older. Kwe grew 4 inches in one summer, while Cujo grew muscle. His legs and arms rippled, so that sweat flowing down them looked like cresting waves. He became known far and wide for his wrestling prowess. Older boys from neighboring villages were brought to challenge him, and still he won every match. "Hey, Kwe, when will you wrestle me?" Cujo asked. Kwe had never challenged him. He was nervous. Not of losing, for he knew he would lose, but because he'd spent the last 3 years carefully watching, and knew better than anyone what Cujo's body was capable of. The elegance of Cujo's movements as he circled around his opponents, the mathematics of the violence, how an arm plus a neck could equal breathlessness, or an elbow plus a nose meant blood. Cujo never missed a step in this dance, and his body, both forceful and controlled, awed Quay. Lately, Quay had been thinking about Cujo's strong arms encircling him, dragging him down to the ground, Cujo's body on top of his. "Get Richard to wrestle you," Quay said, and Cujo let out his exuberant laugh. After the snail race, the boys had started to name everything good or bad Richard. When they got into trouble with their mothers for saying something crude, they blamed Richard. When they ran the fastest, or won a wrestling match, it was thanks to Richard. Richard was there the day Cujo had swum too far out, and his strokes had started to fail him. It was Richard who had wanted him to drown, and Richard who had saved him, helping him to regain his rhythm. "Poor Richard. I would destroy him, oh," Cujo said, flexing his muscles. Quay reached over to squeeze Cujo's arm. Though the muscle did not give way, he said, "Why? Because of this small thing?" "Hmm?" Cujo said. "I said this arm is small. It feels soft in my hand, brother." Without warning, quick as a stroke of heat lightning, Cujo locked Quay's neck into his arms. "Soft?" he asked. His voice was hardly more than a whisper, a wind in Quay's ear. "Careful, friend. There is nothing soft here." Though Quay was losing his breath, he could feel his cheeks flushing. Cujo's body was pressed so close to him that he felt, for a moment, that they were one body. Each hair on Quay's arms stood at attention, waiting for what would happen next. Finally, Cujo let him go. Quay took in deep gulps of air as Cujo looked on, a smile playing on his lips. "Were you scared, Quay?" Cujo asked.
"No."
"No? Don't you know every man in Fantilan is scared of me now?" "You wouldn't hurt me," Quay said. He looked straight into Cujo's eyes and could feel something in them falter. Quickly, Cujo regained his composure. "Are you sure?" "Yes," Quay said. "Challenge me, then. Challenge me to wrestle." "I won't." Cujo walked up to Quay until he was standing only inches from his face. "Challenge me," he said, and his breath danced on Quay's own lips. The next week, Cujo had an important match. While drunk, a soldier in the castle had boasted that Cujo would never be able to beat him. "Negroes fighting other Negroes is not a challenge. Put a savage against a white man, then you'll see." One of his servants, a man from Cujo's own village, had heard the white soldier's boast and reported it back to Cujo's father. The next day, the chief arrived to deliver his message personally. "Any white man who thinks he can beat my son, let him try. In 3 days' time, we will see who is better." Quay's father had tried to forbid the match, saying that it was uncivilized. But the soldiers were bored and restless. Uncivilized fun was exactly what they craved. Cujo came at the end of that week. He brought with him his father and his 7 brothers. No one else. Quay had not spoken to him since the week before, and he found himself inexplicably nervous, the feeling of Cujo's breath still present on his lips. The soldier who had made the boast was also nervous. He paced, and his hand shook, as all the men of the castle looked on. Cujo stood across from his challenger, He looked him up and down, assessing him. Then his eyes found Quay's in the audience. Quay nodded at him, and Cujo smiled. A smile that Quay knew to mean, I will win this. And he did. Only a minute after the match started, Cujo had his arms wrapped around the soldier's fat belly, flipping him over and pinning him down. The crowd roared with excitement. More challengers stepped in, soldiers whom Cujo defeated with varying degrees of ease until finally, all the men were drunk and spent, and Cujo, alone, was unruffled. The soldiers started to leave. After congratulating Cujo loudly and raucously, his own brothers and father also left. Cujo was to spend the night in the Cape Coast with Quay. I'll wrestle you, Quay said, when it looked like everyone had gone. The night air was starting to move into the castle, cooling it, but only a bit. Now that I'm too tired to win? Cujo asked. You've never been too tired to win. Okay. You want to wrestle me? Come catch me first. And with that, Cujo broke into a run. Quay was faster than he was in the early years of their friendship. He caught up to Cujo at the cannons and dove toward him, locking his legs and pulling him down to the ground. Within seconds, Cujo was on top of him, panting heavily while Quay struggled to turn him over. Quay knew he should tap the ground 3 times, the signal to end the match. But he didn't want to. He didn't want to. He didn't want Cujo to get up. He didn't want to miss the weight of him. Slowly, Quay relaxed his body, and he felt Cujo do the same. The boys drank in each other's gazes. Their breathing slowed. The feeling on Quay's lips grew stronger, a tingling that threatened to draw his face up toward Cujo's. Get up right now, James said. Quay didn't know how long his father had been standing there watching them, but he recognized a new tone in his father's voice. It was the same measured control he used when he spoke to servants and, Quay knew, though he'd never seen, to slaves before he struck them. But now, there was fear mixed in. Go home, Cujo, James said. Quay watched his friend leave. Cujo didn't even look back. The next month, just before Quay's 14th birthday, while Afia cried and fought some more, going so far once as to strike James across the face, Quay boarded a ship bound for England. I heard you're back from London. Can I see you, old friend? Quay couldn't stop thinking about the message he'd received from Cujo. He stared into his bowl and saw that he'd hardly eaten any of the porridge. Fifi had already finished one bowl and asked for another. Maybe I should have stayed in London, Quay said. His uncle looked up from his meal and gave him a funny look. Stayed in London for what? It was safer there, Quay said softly. Safer? Why? Because the British don't tramp through bushland finding slaves? Because they keep their hands clean while we work? Let me tell you, the work they do is the most dangerous of all. Quay nodded, though it wasn't what he'd meant. In England, he'd gotten to see the way black people lived in white countries. Indians and Africans who were packed 20 or more to a room, who ate the slop the pigs left behind, who coughed and coughed and coughed endlessly, all together, a symphony of sickness. He knew the dangers that waited across the Atlantic, but he knew, too, the danger in himself. Don't be weak, Quay, Fifi said, staring at him intently, and for just a second, Quay wondered if his uncle had understood him after all. But then Fifi returned to his porridge and said, Isn't there work for you to do? Quay shook his head, trying to collect himself. He smiled at his uncle and thanked him for the meal, and then he set off. The work wasn't difficult. Kwe and his fellow company men's official duties included meeting Badu and his men weekly to go over the inventory, overseeing the bamboys who loaded the canoes with cargo, and updating the castle's governor with the news of Badu's other trade partners. Today it was Kwe's turn to oversee the bamboys. He walked the several miles to the edge of the village and greeted the young Fanti boys who worked for the British, shuttling slaves from the coastal village to the castle. On this day, there were only 5 slaves, bound and waiting. The youngest, a small girl, had messed herself, but everyone ignored it. Kwe had grown accustomed to the smell of shit, but fear was one smell that would stand out forever. It curled his nose and brought tears to his eyes, but he had learned long ago how to keep himself from crying. Every time he saw the bamboys set off with a canoe full of slaves, he thought of his father standing on the shores of the Cape Coast castle, ready to receive them. On this shore, watching the canoe push off, Kwe brimmed with the same shame that accompanied each slave departure. What had his father felt on his shore? James had died soon after Kwe arrived in London. The ship ride there had been uncomfortable at best, harrowing at worst, with Kwe alternating steadily between crying and vomiting. On the ship, all Kwe could think about was how this was what his father did to the slaves. This was what his father did to his problems. Put them on a boat. Shipped them away. How had James felt every time he watched a ship push off? Was it the same mix of fear and shame and loathing that Kwe felt for his own flesh, his mutinous desire? Back in the village, Badu was already drunk. Kwe said hello and then tried to move quickly past him. He wasn't fast enough. Badu grabbed him by the shoulder and asked, "How is your mother? Tell her to come and see me, eh?" Kwe pursed his lips into what he hoped looked like a smile. He tried to swallow his disgust. When he'd accepted his assignment here, a fear had cried out, begging him to refuse, begging him to run away, all the way into Ashanti, as his never-known grandmother before him had done, if that was what he needed to do in order to escape the obligation. She'd fingered the stone pendant on her neck as she spoke to him. "There is evil in that village, Kwe."
Baba is long dead," Kwe said, "and you and I are both too old to still believe in ghosts." His mother had spit on the ground at his feet and shook her head so quickly he thought it might spin off. "You think you know, but you don't know," she said. "Evil is like a shadow. It follows you."
"Perhaps my mother will come visit soon," Kwe said now, knowing that she would never want to see Badu. Though his parents had fought, mostly about him, it was obvious to all that they had cared for each other. And though a part of Kwe hated his father, another part still wanted ardently to please him. Kwe finally freed himself from Badu and kept on walking. Cujo's message repeated in his head. "I heard you're back from London. Can I see you, old friend?" When Kwe had returned from London, he'd been too nervous to ask after Cujo, but he hadn't needed to. Cujo had taken over as chief of his old village, and they still traded with the British. Kwe had recorded Cujo's name in the castle ledgers nearly every day when he was still working as a writer. It would be easy enough now to go see Cujo, to talk as they used to tell him that he had hated London as he had hated his father, that everything about the place, the cold, the damp, the dark, had felt like a personal slight against him,
designed for the sole purpose of keeping him away from Cujo. But what good could come of seeing him? Would one look have him back where he'd been 6 years ago, back on that castle floor? Maybe London had done what his father had hoped it would do, but then again, maybe it hadn't. Weeks went steadily on, and still Quay sent no answer to Cujo. Instead, he devoted himself to his work. Fifi and Badu had numerous contacts in Ashantiland and further north. Big men, warriors, chiefs and the like, who would bring in slaves each day by the tens and twenties. Trade had increased so much, and the methods of gathering slaves had become so reckless, that many of the tribes had taken to marking their children's faces so that they would be distinguishable. Northerners, who were most frequently captured, could have upwards of 20 scars on their faces, making them too ugly to sell. Most of the slaves brought to Quay's village outpost were those people captured in tribal wars. A few were sold by their families, and the rarest kind of slave was the one that Fiafi captured himself in his dark night missions up north. Fiafi was preparing himself for one such journey. He wouldn't tell Quay what the mission was, but Quay knew it had to be something particularly treacherous, for his uncle had sought help from another Fanti village. "You can keep all the captives but one," Fiafi was saying to someone. "Take them back with you when we split up in Dunkwa." Quay had just been summoned to his compound. Before him, warriors were dressing for battle, muskets, machetes, and spears in hand. Quay moved further in, trying to see the man his uncle spoke to.
"Ah, Quay, you finally come to greet me,
The voice was deeper than Quay remembered, and yet he knew it immediately. His hand trembled as he held it out to shake with his old friend. Cujo's grip was firm, his hand soft. The handshake took Quay back to Cujo's village, to the snail race, to Richard. "What are you doing here?" Quay asked. He hoped his voice didn't betray him. He hoped he sounded calm and sure.
"Your uncle has promised us a good mission today. I was eager to accept."
Fifi clapped Cujo's shoulder and moved on to speak to the warriors.
"You never returned my message," Cujo said softly.
"I didn't have time."
"I see," Cujo said.
He looked the same, taller, broader, but the same.
"Your uncle tells me you haven't yet married."
"No.
I married last spring. A chief must be married."
"Oh, right," Quay said in English, forgetting himself. Cujo laughed. He took up his machete and leaned in closer to Quay.
"You speak English like a British man. Just like Richard, When I have finished up north with your uncle, I will return to my own village. You are always welcome there. Come and see me."
Fifi gave one last cry to gather the men, and Cujo went running. As he sped off, Cujo glanced back and smiled at Quay. Quay didn't know how long they would be gone, but he knew he would not sleep until his uncle returned. No one had told him anything about the mission. Indeed, Quay had seen the warriors go out a handful of times and never questioned it. But now his heart thumped so hard, it felt like a toad had replaced his throat. He could taste every beat. Why had Fifi told Cujo that Quay wasn't married? Had Cujo asked? How could Quay be welcomed in Cujo's village? Would he live in the chief's compound, in his own hut, like a third wife? Or would he be in a hut on the edge of the village alone? The toad croaked. There was a way. There was no way. There was a way. Quay's mind raced back and forth with every thump. 1 week passed, then two, then three. On the first day of the fourth week, Kuei was finally summoned to the slave cellar. Fifi was lying against the wall of the cellar, his hand covering his flank as it oozed blood from a large gash. Soon one of the company doctors arrived with a thick needle and thread and began sewing Fifi up.
"What happened?" Kuei asked.
Fifi's men were guarding the cellar door, clearly shaken. They held both machetes and muskets, and when so much as a leaf rustled in the woods, they would clutch each weapon tighter. Fifi began laughing, a sound like the last roar of a dying animal. The doctor finished closing up the wound and poured a brown liquid over it, causing Fifi to stop laughing and cry out.
"Quiet!"
one of Fifi's soldiers said. "We don't know who may have followed us." Kuei knelt down to meet his uncle's eyes.
"What happened?"
Fifi was gnashing his teeth against the slow-moving wind. He lifted an arm and pointed to the cellar door.
"Look what we have brought, my son," he said.
Kuei stood up and went to the door. Fifi's men handed him a lamp and then moved aside so that he could enter. When he did, the darkness echoed around him, reverberating against him as though he had stepped inside a hollowed drum. He lifted the lamp higher and saw the slaves. He didn't expect to see many, for the next shipment was not set to arrive until early the following week. He knew immediately that these were not slaves the Ashantis brought in. These were people Fifi had stolen. There were two men tied together in the corner, big warriors, bleeding from minor flesh wounds. When they saw Kuei, they began to jeer in Cree, thrashing against their chains so that they broke fresh flesh, bleeding anew. On the opposite wall sat a young girl who made no noise. She looked up at Kuei with large moon eyes, and he knelt down beside her to study her face. On her cheek was a large, oval-shaped scar, a medical mark James had taught Kuei years before he'd shipped him off to England, a mark of the Ashantis. Kuei got up, looking at the girl still. Slowly, he backed away, realizing who the girl must be. Outside, his uncle had passed out from the pain, and the soldiers had loosened their grips on their weapons, content that no one had followed them. Kuei looked at the one closest to the door, grabbed his shoulder, shook him.
"What in God's name are you doing with the Ashanti king's daughter?"
The soldier lowered his eyes, shook his head, and did not speak. Whatever Fifi had planned, it could not fail, or the entire village would pay with their lives. Every night after that night, Kuei sat with Fifi as he healed. He heard the story of the capture, how Fifi and his men had stolen into Ashanti in the dead of night, informed by one of their contacts as to when the girl would have the fewest guards around her, how Fifi had been slit around like a coconut by the tip of her guard's machete when he reached for her, how they had dragged their captives south, through the forest, until they reached the coast. Her name was Nana Ya, and she was the eldest daughter of Ose Bansu, the highest power in the Ashanti kingdom, a man who commanded respect from the Queen of England herself for his sway over the Gold Coast role in the slave trade. Nana Ya was an important political bargaining tool, and people had been trying to capture her since her infancy. Wars had been started over her, to get her, to free her, to marry her. Kuei was so worried he didn't dare ask how Cujo had fared. Soon, Kuei knew, Fifi's informant would be caught and tortured until he told who had taken her. It was only a matter of time until the consequences came to meet them.
"Uncle,
The Ashantis will not forgive us for this. They will... Fifi cut him off. Since the night of the capture, every time Quay tried to broach the topic of the girl, to gauge Fifi's intentions, the man climbed...